Welcome to the Biblical Languages Podcast, brought to you by Biblingo. We bring together the latest research in linguistics, language acquisition, and biblical studies to better understand the biblical languages and ultimately the biblical text. As always, this episode is brought to you by Biblingo, the premier solution for learning, maintaining, and enjoying the biblical languages. Visit biblingo.org to learn more and start your 10-day free trial.
I am Kevin Grosso, your host for this episode, and I'm excited to talk with Dr. Max Botner today about his new book, Beyond the Greek New Testament, Advanced Readings for Students at Biblical Studies. Welcome to the show, Max.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So just a little bit about Max. He has served as a lecturer and researcher in the US, UK, and Germany. His primary research interests include Jewish exegetical practices, ancient messianism and early Christology, and early Jewish and Christian sacrificial theologies. Above all, he is passionate about training students, clergy, and lay leaders to know and embody the biblical story. Currently, Max serves as associate professor for the School of Theology and Leadership at Jessup. And so this book is what the title says, reading outside of the New Testament. So can you tell us a little bit about what this book is and who it is for?
Yeah, sure. So the kind of seedbed for this book came from my former position. I was a New Testament professor at a seminary, Grand Rapids Theological Seminary. And we had a decent number of students who were really interested in going on to do PhD work. And we had a pretty robust Greek program there, exegetical program for a seminary. It was pretty robust. And I thought, you know, one thing I'd like to add for students is an advanced Greek reading course. So as I started to think about what that course would entail, that's kind of when I started to think about this book. And I was talking with a colleague and he said, you know, why don't you just write a book, put together material, do the book. And I was like, okay. A lot more involved than I had initially anticipated, but some of the readings in the book I used with the students in that class. So these were THM students and kind of like advanced MDiv students. And the idea was really twofold. One is just to give people an array of different authors that they could read, some of which, or maybe most of which, would be more challenging than a lot of the authors they would read in the New Testament in terms of like syntax and style and things like that. And then also to select readings that would be interesting for students of biblical studies. So one of my favorite things in the classroom that semester was when I would give students text from the New Testament to read alongside some of those readings. And I had students come into class, their eyes wide open, like, oh, you know, what's going on here? And so it was really, really cool to kind of see those aha moments throughout the semester. So that was a feature. They all said, you got to put this in the book. Make sure you have, you know, suggested readings from the New Testament alongside the readings you're having us do, because that's really exciting. So I included that in the book as well. So yeah, that's a little bit about it. Another facet to this was I did my PhD work in the UK. And so a lot of the students there were coming in from, you know, seminary context, divinity school context. And the UK program, for those that don't know, it's kind of set up pretty old school. I think it's like basically assuming back in the day when people were taking Latin in kindergarten and like reading Greek throughout. And so you just come into your seminary or your PhD work and you know everything already, supposedly. I mean, that's kind of the idea. This is go study, go be a scholar now. And I just realized that even a lot of people coming into PhD programs needed a lot of work on their Greek. That was certainly the case for me when I did my seminary work. I learned Greek one night a week at an extension campus, going through mounts, you know, if many of you are familiar with that. And I finished that and I was like, okay, I don't know what to do now. Like, I don't know how to read Greek. So fortunately, I found my way into a classics program at UC Davis, and that sort of blew my mind. And it made me realize, wow, people can't actually read this stuff if you put in the work and you have the right pathway. So it was also just to kind of encourage people that are going into biblical studies. Like, you don't have to settle for the rest of your life just being attached to Accordants or Bible Works. Well, that's I still have my Bible Works, even though that they went out of business. Bible Works or Logos or whatever. Like, you can actually sit down and read these texts. And the benefit from that is just, I mean, you can't even really put a value on it. So I also had, that kind of broad audience in mind. Basically, anybody that's had a year or two of Greek, particularly interested in biblical studies, here are a bunch of texts that I think are going to be really interesting for you. And as you work through them, not only are you going to gain a great understanding of the world of the New Testament, it's also going to be make the reading the New Testament a heck of a lot easier when you go back to do it.
Yeah, for sure. That's great. Yeah, and I completely agree. I mean, I think it is quite unfortunate that within the New Testament world, there are at least some people kind of in this like New Testament Greek silo, as if New Testament Greek is even a thing.
It's like a thing. I know. I always feel weird even writing New Testament Greek. Like, yeah, it's a phrase that I know people use, and so they'll know what I mean by that, but it just seems so wrong to even write it.
No, for sure. I mean, it is, like, especially if you find a word that's used only once, it's like, okay, it's only used once in this very small corpus, but right. Like, that doesn't mean it's only used once in Greek, I mean,
right.
And
yeah,
how does that inform how we read the text, it's so yeah, I mean, I think the general idea is just fantastic. So I wanted to touch on this one thing before we get into it, just thinking about how people are going to use this and really what reading is. This podcast will be a part of this series that we're doing on reading. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't really understand. Like when they enter Greek 101 or Greek 102, they're actually not going to read that much most of the time.
Yeah.
Which is, most people though want to be able to read by the end, but because they haven't done it, they can't. So yes. Well, so you say this at the beginning, a fundamental premise of this reader is that the best way to learn vocabulary and grammar is by reading as much Greek as possible. So first of all, what do you mean by reading? I mean, I know this is like kind of trivial, but what do you mean by reading as much Greek as possible?
Yeah, it strikes me that a lot of these New Testament books, the most they ask of students is to read a verse here or there, or translate it, or a couple verses maybe. And so what I'm thinking is, substantive texts of Greek passages, working through reading them. Maybe if you're reading it afresh, maybe you struggle through it at first, but you come back to it a few times until you can read through it and feel like you're understanding the flow of the argument. I mean, maybe not quite at the pace you'd read English, but at a decent pace that you feel confident that you're not like stuck at every other word, looking up a word, or you can instantly look at the text and at least at the very minimum see the larger kind of clause structure, how the discourse is being put together. Maybe you will look up a word or two that's unfamiliar, but moving towards a greater facility to just read the text.
So along these lines, kind of to play devil's advocate here, so why do you provide the student with grammar explanations and glosses? So the point being, right, you wouldn't get that if you're reading through an English novel, right? Like you're just going to be reading.
Right.
And actually, the more footnotes there are in an English book, the less you're going to be reading the body of the text, right? Mm-hmm. And the more you're going to be it's a kind of reading, right? But it's a different kind of reading.
Yes,
right?
Yes, I mean, it's a different kind of reading.
SLA
yes.
scholars would actually call this intensive reading versus extensive reading. So extensive reading is you're going to be reading a large swath of text and you're just consuming, right? Mm-hmm. But intensive reading is you're looking at the grammar. You're looking at language features or vocabulary features. So how should those be used? And, why provide those?
Yeah, it's a great question. This was probably my biggest struggle with creating this book, was trying to figure out the amount of help that my audience would need. And I based it off of the feedback I got from students that had about a year to a year and a half, in some cases 2 years of Greek. But I also leaned kind of more on the side of giving more help than less help. And so the idea with the notes is, one, I didn't want people to get frustrated, throw the book down because they realized to read this author, they basically have to have a dictionary open every other word or something like that. So there was a little bit of that with words that I felt like I maybe over the top on some places, but words that were like used maybe 30 times or less in the New Testament, I tried to provide vocabulary just so, again, they're not leaving the text, they're not having this experience of this to another dictionary or looking at a computer screen and back over and over and over again. So there's vocabulary. And then the grammar part is mostly just instructional. So it's designed to fill in gaps that students might not have gotten if they learned to read Greek at a seminary or divinity school, primarily geared towards the New Testament. So there's certain like Attic constructions, for example, that students might never have seen. Mm-hmm. And so I provide explanations of what that looks like. Other constructions that I, in my experience as a teacher, students struggle with the most, those are particularly the things that I honed in on were grammar. So it's basically like as they're reading through, is an opportunity to reinforce some grammar principles that may not be their strong suit as they're going through. And I hope for those that are maybe a little bit more advanced, the notes aren't too annoying or distracting. But yeah, I thought as I was thinking about this book, I was thinking about numerous people that I know or, you know, kind of imagine who are going to need a little bit of extra help and might not be using this in a formal classroom where there are other people walking them through. And so I just kind of, with that in mind, I wanted to provide as much help as possible to students. And I hope it's a worthy trade-off, but the hardest part of writing the book for sure was determining to what extent did I want to provide grammar explanations and to what extent should I leave it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, to be fair, I think it's a great idea that you did that. I think one thing that might be helpful for students is, you know, just very practically, like working through the text slowly one time with your notes, with the vocab, learning that vocab through a flashcard program of your choice, right? And then going back and reading the text, like yeah. a text, you know?
100%. And
just getting, because I think that's the one of the great features is, you know, you have all of these texts in one convenient place, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, we eventually want to get people to the original texts.
That's the whole goal. I say that in the introduction.
Yeah.
If this book is successful, it will move you away from this book. Like right. this is just a means to an end, right?
Right?
So the idea is if you work through the Philo readings, for example, I would feel pretty confident at the end of that you could pick up a work of Philo and work through an entire book of Philo.
Yeah.
At a slower pace, but it would feel much more doable than if you just jumped into Philo and all you had done was a little bit of New Testament stuff, for example.
Well, and I think that's kind of a larger point about how to read some of these texts in general is, you know, you don't just go one time and say, okay, I worked through the text and I'm done, right? It, like going through it and trying to figure out what's going on kind of mm-hmm. piece by piece, and then going back and reading it, having mm-hmm. figured that out is mm-hmm. a much more effective strategy because mm-hmm. the first time around, you really, again, there's a lot of literature on this, but basically there's a correlation between reading speed and reading comprehension. Mm-hmm. So if you are reading too slowly, you will not comprehend it as well. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is you can't hold enough things in your head. So mm-hmm. like you can't be thinking about, you know, chapter one of Romans if you're in chapter eight and chapter one was 3 days ago, right?
Just or 6 months ago or whatever.
Right. Yeah. You know, exactly. I mean, it's like, yeah. it just doesn't yeah. work. Like it should yeah. be 30 minutes ago. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you can make those kinds of connections. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. But so if you don't read fast enough, then mm-hmm. you actually comprehension will go down. So yeah, but I think that's great. So what do you think is the value in general? So just if you were to like give an elevator pitch for, hey, convince me to read Greek outside of the New Testament, why should we do that?
Yeah, it's for anybody that has taken some Greek, even if there's been a gap in their learning. I mean, they didn't have to just finish a class. It's for anybody that is really interested in study of the, you know, early Christianity, the world of the New Testament, broadly ancient Mediterranean world, who wants to embark on a life of reading Greek. So it's a roadmap, as it were, to a lifetime of enjoying the vast corpus or corpora of Greek literature that's available. And I want people to know that if they've already invested the time at a seminary or somewhere else into some grammar, yeah, you might need a little bit of remedial work, but you can do this. If you want to do it, you can do it. And I want to encourage people that there's so much great literature out there to read. And when you do, it's only going to help you understand the New Testament better if that's your ultimate aim.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, in your book, you have different sections and they're not necessarily, I mean, you could in theory start at any section, right? They're mm-hmm. not linear in any kind of way. Where do you suggest people start? I mean, is it just like what interests them? Is there an order by difficulty? I think you mentioned that in the preface or introduction.
Yeah, I think people are going to find, if they're looking in, if they're thinking in order of difficulty, I think they'll find the first few sections the easiest. The Septuagint section, I think for sure, Apostolic Fathers as well, and even some, you know, Greek pseudepigrapha. You could read through Joseph and Aseneth, for example, and it'll feel easier than a lot of the books in the New Testament. So there's writings in there as well that I think people can jump into. So in terms of ease, it does sort of work that way in the first few sections. From then, it gets significantly harder, I would say. Even some pseudepigrapha, because some of the authors I included in there are writing epic poetry. And so that's going to feel really weird to people if that's the first time they've, you know, engaged that. But I'm a big believer that if you're interested in a topic, it'll provide that extra motivation. So if somebody, you know, got the book and they're just really itching to read like Philo or Josephus, I would say, fine, just go ahead, go to section 4, go to section 5, start there. But I think people will get the most benefit from just working through all of the sections. And I think in sequence, because that will kind of ensure that you're getting the full range of text that the reader was designed to provide.
Yeah, that's great. So I think at this point, what I would like to do is just kind of go through some of these sections, go through some of your notes, talk about some of the, you know, interesting things in here. Like we have discussed, like there are some passages in here that you could spend a very long time on, and much has been written on in the commentaries and such. So the first one actually is I did my dissertation work on righteousness language in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And so I have, you know, some thoughts about it, but I want to hear from you. Isaiah 53:11.
Yeah.
So whoever, you know, Isaiah 53 is such an interesting passage because it's so hard in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. It's so, and people, I mean, you obviously there's like reasons why it's been very influential and stuff. But it's just not an easy text. And I don't think it was that easy for our translator either.
No. There's some idiosyncrasies in the translation, for sure. And, you know, there's some differences between the MT and some of the Dead Sea Scrolls as well. But yeah, I mean, if you look at like modern commentaries on this, the number of emendations that are proposed and all this kind of stuff, it's just a hornet's nest of issues.
Yes. Yeah. So the text at the end of 53:11, Yatzdik Tzadik Avdi Le'Rabim. I don't even want to translate it because I would give away, you know. I would have to translate it. I would have to like put it, my thoughts out there. So, which I'm not even sure of. What is the theological significance of this translation? I mean, okay, so I should say most translations. Thing like the ESV, for example, would probably say something like, you know, the righteous one, my servant, will make the many righteous, or something like that, or justify the many. Again, I'm forgetting how English translations do
sounds
it.
Sounds
like that. So what does the old Greek translator do with this, and why does it matter?
Yeah, the old Greek. So the with the first hifil,
that's Yatzdik.
Yeah. Yatzdik, the translator has kind of made a decision to take a number of third person singular verbs and make them a series of infinitives that kind of go back to that first phrase about the Lord desired. Hold on, I have my text in front of me. Let me grab it real quick. Yeah, the Lord desired to cleanse him of the blow or something like that is literally in the Greek. And there's this conditional phrase, which is kind of interesting. If you plural give a sin offering, so it's like his group that repents in light of what the servant's done. And then there's a series of another infinitive, the Lord desired to remove this from him, and then there's a series of infinitives. So
what verse is this?
This is now verse 11. Yeah. Okay. So it picks up a series of infinitives where if you look in the Hebrew text, they appear to be third person singulars, but the Greek translator has made it basically allows God to continue as the subject of these actions rather than this servant figure. So we have here in the Greek, we have dikaiosai. So we have the infinitive and then dikaion. So it goes infinitive, and then rather than having Yatzdik as a either kind of the subject of the sentence, right? The righteous one, or however you take that with the servant. Now we have dikaion. So that is the direct object of the infinitive. So now we have he justified the righteous one. And then I think the translator reads, instead of reading my servant, if you don't read the, or maybe if you read it, but read it as something else, you can read it as kind of a participle. I think Symmachus also reads it that way, but uses a different verb of serving. And so he reads that as a participle with this little adverb, flavoring adverb, eo. So serving the many well. So now we've got a construction where God righteouses, justifies the righteous one who served the many well. So it's about vindication of the servant figure in the Greek text.
So which, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I say that idea of vindication of the servant figure, I think does make good sense. You could argue Daniel 12, maybe one of the earliest interpretations of Isaiah 53. And there the wise ones, the maskilim, are justified or made. Yeah, there's that kind of idea at least. Yeah, it's a very interesting text. I think Martin Hengel says this is like the seedbed of the idea that through the resurrection, God justified Jesus the Messiah. That was his suggestion, at least.
So. The significance of this, right, is, I mean, I think from a Greek Hebrew perspective, in Hebrew, it is quite unclear. Like, people have argued, what is the object, for example? Mm-hmm. That is a big problem in the text. And mm-hmm. most of the English translations take le rabim to be the object, which I think is like totally mm-hmm. untenable. Because Yetzdik just doesn't take lay yeah. as an argument, but anyway,
you have a question about who the many are in that, yep. that context.
Who are the many?
The many could be like the adversaries in front of whom the righteous one is vindicated or something like that.
Right. So the issue is that, you know, we don't, like, there are some things in the Hebrew that are kind of in question, right? I was just looking up the ESV translation here. It says, you know, by his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous. Mm-hmm. So that, again, make many to be accounted righteous, I'm arguing, is really not right. I don't think you can get there with the Hebrew. But the old Greek doesn't say that. But it, like, Greek forces you to make a decision on the syntax with how you translate. Right. Whereas Hebrew does not. Right. Because mm-hmm. Hebrew doesn't have a necessary accusative case. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you can read Avdi one way or the mm-hmm. other. You can read Tzadik, mm-hmm. you know, as a subject or an object. And all of these different proposals have been given. But the Greek, you know, translator says, OK, no, it's dikaiosai dikaion. Right. Mm-hmm. It is to justify the dikaion, the righteous one. Mm-hmm. So and that is indisputable according mm-hmm. to the Greek, right? You can't get around that. So it's what's very interesting about that, right, then, is if New Testament authors are reading the Septuagint or some early version of it, you know, they can pick up on this idea. And, you know, again, what they're doing with this, I mean, it's hard to say, but
it makes sense at like the end of Romans 4, for example, or yep. you know, in First Timothy? I think there's a text in First Timothy two. As well.
Yeah. No. So obviously we know that this text was influential, right, within early Christian circles. So, you know, I mean, that it's a very interesting way to go back and see, okay, how were the New Testament authors influenced by, you know, mm-hmm. the Greek version of this text? Again, it doesn't even necessarily mean that the Greek translator was right.
Yeah. Right.
But.
And the Greek text itself has all kinds of questions as well, which is really interesting too.
Right.
And one thing I've noticed that's maybe be interesting to some people, you want to be cautious of this. I've even found a lot of biblical scholars will do this kind of conflated thing where they take elements of the old Greek and elements of the Masoretic text and do like theology from that. So it's like a combined text of Isaiah that no one had access to that we know of. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So these are, you know, obviously really difficult syntactic questions, but I mean, it shows the value of just reading the Septuagint for itself. You know, mm-hmm. if you just actually just read the Septuagint, and again, it's very unclear who in the early church is reading what. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Paul is definitely reading the Septuagint. Mm-hmm. You know, how much he's reading the Hebrew is debated. But if he was just reading the Septuagint, like on this passage, then he is going to, you know, have a limited set of options for how he interprets it that's different than the set of options for the Hebrew version, right?
Yes.
I think that's the key kind of point.
Yeah, absolutely, 100%.
So just moving on to, you know, another random one. So this is Isaiah is obviously in the Protestant canon, so we can go and compare to the Hebrew text. Then we come to some texts that are, you know, in the, let's say, broader canon.
Deuterocanonical or something.
Yes. So like the Maccabees, right? So we have this very interesting text about in Second Maccabees. First of all, can you tell us what is going on in Second Maccabees, in the sections that you chose? And then I have a grammar question for you on that passage.
Fun. Yes. So on the Septuagint section as well, I wanted to have a range of some texts that were translations of Hebrew texts and then some that were original Greek compositions. So Second Maccabees, original Greek composition. I mean, maybe there's a underlying Hebrew source to a part of it or something like that. But I mean, it's pretty well understood and it reads good Greek. The author is well educated. It's a fun text to read. The section that I chose is this iconic section in chapter 7, where you have a mother and her 7 sons. And Antiochus Epiphanes, we all know he's the big bad guy. I grew up in a Jewish home, so this is one of the parts of the story that I always knew, because every Hanukkah, you know about the Maccabees and Antiochus. And so he wants to unite his, I mean, this is the way, you know, it's presented in the very sources we have. He wants to unite his empire. He's a Seleucid ruler. And to do that, he turns in disdain on the Jewish people who have these particular customs, Sabbath maintenance, circumcision. They worship one God in this aniconic temple. And so he launches a campaign against them. And we have a lot of that in the First Maccabees. Second Maccabees gets into some of these martyrdom stories where heroes like the priest Eleazar, who's also the subject in 4th Maccabees, and then the mother and her 7 sons, which is the focus of this reading in chapter 7, they step forward and they give themselves in witness to, on behalf of, they die for their ancestral traditions. And they do so kind of in opposition to this pagan ruler. And so the mother has to watch her 7 sons basically be tortured and dismembered before her. And throughout the whole thing, she's kind of like cheering them on. Like, I didn't bear you. I held you in my womb. I gave birth to you. You better stay true to the law, you know, kind of thing. And so it's this really interesting text. A lot of people who get into New Testament studies get interested in this text as well, because there's a lot of discussion of resurrection. And it's one of our earlier discussions of bodily resurrection. And so that's another point of interest to people, because when the sons are being dismembered by Antiochus, they tell him that they worship the creator of the universe, who can give them back. There, you can take my tongue out of my mouth, but God can give it back. You can cut off my hands, God can recreate them. But what is he going to do to you, good sir, when the time for judgment comes, kind of thing? So yeah, it's a really important text. It's one a lot of people have focused on, and I thought it would be one that would be fun to have in the book.
Yeah, for sure. It's also, I mean, I think very interesting in light of some of the, you know, apostolic fathers' literature, just the kind of obsession with martyrdom, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you see that, you know, mm-hmm. the seeds of that in these 100%. Kinds of texts.
Yeah, it's 100%.
So, which again is it's striking when you kind of go from the New Testament to the Apostolic Fathers. You're like, what? You know, this is like. But if you read all of the literature before, you know, especially the Jewish literature, it's like, you know, you can see that.
Yeah, they're engaged in conversation with that. And a really good work for people that might be interested in that connection is Daniel Boyarin has a book. Is it Dying for Dying for God, I believe it's called. And he does some really interesting comparative work between early Jewish martyrdom texts, early Christian martyrdom texts.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know he had that. I will be looking that up. So that's great. So my grammar question is on, let's see, 7:9. I'm just pulling it up here. So, you know, it says, so I'll just read it in Greek and then I just found a translation online. Hode tu kosmu basileos apothanontas hemas hyper ton autu nomon. Es ionion anabiosin does hemas anastase. So the thing that kind of struck me as I was reading through this is hyper ton autu nomon.
The plural.
Right. Mm-hmm. So any thoughts on why? So again, if, you know, I'm just like implanting my conception of that world onto the text, I would think it would read huper tu autu nomu, with
like a singular the law kind of
exactly
thing.
Exactly. But the claim is that, you know, they're dying for
the customs or the laws.
The laws, plural. Right? Yeah. I mean, and that's how, you know, so like the I just again pulled up a Catholic translation of it. You know, it says, but the king of the universe will raise us up to live again forever because we are dying for his laws. So any thoughts on the significance of his laws versus law?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's funny because I think it's very hard for us to get beyond law framework in the post kind of like what Christians do with law language, and particularly the way law gets weaponized in, you know, Protestant Christianity, really as a weapon against Catholics, actually. primarily. But trying to get back into a mindset of a late Second Temple Jew. Okay, there is kind of a framework of Torah, but in this context, these laws or customs are these particular things that make them a distinct people. Right. They're the things that, would make them the Jewish ethnos distinct in the ancient Mediterranean world. And they're particularly important things that God gave, you know, some authors say is direct commandments, you know, circumcise your son on the eighth day. Well, you're trying to prevent us from circumcising, or, you know, we have our in this case, specifically, they're being tempted to eat pork. And if they just eat pork, you know, even if they pretend to do it, right, mixing stories together, but that's the idea, like their dietary laws, their pattern of worship, circumcision, things like that. Those are the things that they're standing for that make them a particular people. So I think laws plural makes sense there in that it's kind of highlighting these different clusters of commands that make the Jewish people a distinct ethnos in the ancient Mediterranean world. And I mean, Second Maccabees is written, it's written likely in, you know, Egypt or something like that. It's a text of the broader diaspora, you know, and so these are Jews that are aware of their distinctness. They're living amongst their pagan neighbors, and they're living with them, but they have distinct practices that they maintain.
Yeah. And I think you could get a lot of that. Like if you had the singular there, you know, just thinking about like we would probably just interpret it as like, oh, his law, and that includes X, Y, Z, you know. To me, it's interesting to see like just how that word nomos is used here suggests that it doesn't have to refer to this like body of things. You know, it can refer to individual laws, right?
And particular laws.
Yeah, exactly. And so they have these kinds of things in mind as they're dying, you know. And that's what they're giving their lives for. It's not just like some abstract Torah, you know, it's like it is all of the things, you know, that I'm supposed to do, which is just really interesting. The other, I think, you know, big point of connection is huper, right? For huper something. So how does that connect to the New Testament and some of the texts we see there with these sorts of constructions?
Yeah, that's great. So a number of scholars have done work on this kind of dying for language. And the place where it's connected in the New Testament, it's actually kind of been, it's dovetailed with scholars who are interested in atonement more broadly when it comes to the New Testament. So Siliers Breitenbach did some work on this, but the big volume on kind of dying for language, which looks at all the extant Greek formulae that we have, was done. It's in German, fortunately or unfortunately, depending on who you are, but it's like over 500, 600 pages. Christina Eschner, and I'm trying to remember the title of it, but it's something about, you know, these different constructions. And it's as you said, right? When we're thinking about New Testament, we have to think about its broader culture. So it's not as though dying for is something Paul came up with on the spot. You know, this kind of language was available. So in Romans 5, right, when he has that section about, you know, perhaps someone would die for a good person, right? Yeah. Or that kind of language, that's picking up on broader discussions. So you have a lot of texts that speak, some of which are plays, popular plays, dramatic literature. Other texts speak about people who are kind of noble figures that die for, on behalf of their country, the fatherland, that might die, you know, a soldier might die on behalf of the army to save them, you know, these kind of things. So they're not novel or special constructions. There's plenty of examples of that. When it comes to the New Testament, the big question that people get into is, to what extent is what's often referred to as substitutionary atonement involved, right? Jesus taking the place of, dying on behalf of. And sometimes weird things like conversations about sacrifice have gotten woven in there as well, which we can leave off to the side. I mean, I don't think that belongs in that conversation. But you have these constructions in the New Testament about Jesus giving himself for the people. And I think it's picking up on this broader idea of a person giving themselves or dying for, on behalf of, a people group, a city, the laws in this context. They use that kind of construction. So yeah, that I think that's basically the idea.
Yeah, and I think the sacrifice sort of conversation, you know, it's a very natural direction that people go if they say, okay, well, you know, a sacrifice is someone dying for something or someone, and Jesus died for someone, right? And it's, you know, you know, I just pulled up, it's Romans 5:6 there, and it's you know, huper asebon apethanin. So it's very, very close to what we have. I mean,
yeah,
you know, apethanin, same verb, right? And you have huper, same preposition, same. Yeah. I mean, all the elements are pretty much the same except for ungodly, right?
Yeah.
Asebon, yeah. Versus ton nomon. Mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't claim, right, about the text in Second Maccabees in this construction that there's any sacrifice going on, that there's any, you know, I mean, he's just saying that this is the reason why I'm dying, right? I mean, this is like the cause.
It's giving the cause, reason. Yeah. Yep.
Right. Absolutely. You know, again, so I don't want to get into what the difference between a cause and a reason is, but which is its own conversation. But just the point being that if you just compare these two constructions, and obviously there's way more, you know, to do rather than compare these two verses. But if you do, you do kind of have a simplified version of, like, when it says Jesus dies for the ungodly, it could just mean that Jesus in this passage, right? Mm-hmm. Just that Jesus is dying and the ungodly are the reason why he's dying, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not said that that's all to the story. But if you are reading, you know, this other literature and you see these kinds of constructions, and then you come to these kinds of passages, you say, oh, okay, like this is actually very close, and how can one inform the other?
Yeah. Yeah. And you have you have similar examples in like Euripidean tragedy, where the figure will die on behalf of, with the huper construction. There's some other similar ways of formulating it, other prepositions, but yeah, dying on behalf of the city or something. And that death thwarts off some kind of negative thing that was happening, like some plague that was on the city or something like that. So there can be a sort of apotropaic facet to the death, but that you have to look at context, right? And what is Paul doing there in Romans? He's really making the point, I think, that there's something really remarkable about the way God, Jesus chose to die. Like, we know in other contexts, like, thinking about a little bit about like John Barclay's scholarship on gift giving here. Like, you know, it's kind of almost irresponsible to give a gift or give grace in this way to somebody that doesn't deserve it, because how are they going to use that? Right. And so there's kind of this radical thing that Paul's playing up in this section, I think, about the kind of people that Jesus died for, right? He, while we were still weak, and you know, on this kind of an idea that the recipient of grace here is charis is very undeserving. Let's put it that
yeah.
way.
Yeah. Well, and even just thinking again about, you know, the difference between these two passages. I mean, in the second Maccabees passage, you have people dying for a noble cause. You know, they're dying for God's laws.
Correct.
And in Romans, like, Jesus is not dying for a noble cause, right? I mean, he's dying for the ungodly. I mean, I think that's the whole point.
That's it. That's it. I mean, that's it.
It's supposed to be, you know, you should read it twice. You say, wait, did I read that correctly? Right.
That's and right.
I mean, that's how it reads, you know? Yeah. Anyway, it's very interesting again to read the two together. It's just very easy too, to, because we're so often so familiar with the Romans passage and passages like these, it's very easy to just read through it. But again, if you start to read outside of the New Testament and you start to compare them, oh, it's like Jews are dying for the law, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
the Jewish king is dying for the ungodly, right? I mean, that's
really— Yeah, exactly, right. Yes, you're not going to have somebody bragging about, you know, the Maccabean martyrs are not going to be martyrs for pagans, right? We're not going to die for— exactly,
right. And here, and the Jews aren't expecting a Messiah that would do that, right? I mean,
right,
you precisely just don't see that.
Precisely. Yeah,
yeah,
that's good.
So I know there's like way too many things here, so let's jump to the letter of Aristeas. What is this letter? And why should we read it? And then I'll ask you a question about it.
Yeah, this is a very important text. I got to include some of it in this. And the Greek is a bit choppy, actually. There's a lot of grammatical disjunction and things like that. And as putting it together, I'm like, wow, okay. But yeah, so this is the earliest tradition we have of translation of the scriptures into Greek. It's our earliest legend, if you like. And so that makes it really interesting. Like, what's the origin of the Septuagint? You know, the beginning of translation of Hebrew text into Greek. Well, this is the initial story of 72, it's reduced to 70, I think, by Josephus, scribes from Jerusalem who were brought down by King Ptolemy to translate the Pentateuch into Greek. And that gets added to the great library in Egypt. Most scholars think that this is mostly legendary material, maybe with some kernels of truth, but that its primary function is to demonstrate for diasporic Jews who are reading their scriptures in Greek that their scriptures are just as important, just as authoritative as the Hebrew scriptures that they might not have access to, along with, more broadly, kind of, you know, if there's an eye outward to showing the importance of kind of Judaism as a philosophy, if you will, on par with some of the Greek philosophies. So it's funny, if you read through the letter of Aristeas, a lot of it is actually not the narrative of the translation. A lot of it is the high priest and his team that come down, like they're having this banquet with the Egyptian king, and he's asking them questions, and he's enamored by the great philosophy that is the Judaism that the high priest is presenting. So it's a kind of way of presenting Jewish culture, religion to a broader society as well, that I think would resonate. And you see similarities in like Philo and Josephus as well, to present I think Second Maccabees, especially Fourth Maccabees, the law is this font of philosophy, you know, and so, yeah, it's really interesting. And so then they go to do the translation, they all work together, you know, and then the work is finally read before the king and everybody and the citizenry that's there in Egypt, and everybody just acknowledges this is incredible. And then there's some warnings at the end about other people who have tried to translate, maybe in the past, really interesting, that have played fast and loose with the text and what God did to them, kind of as a warning, like, hey, don't mess with the text on the translation, like this is important, kind of thing. So yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell. It's the it's the seedbed of the traditions that arise around the translation of the Hebrew scriptures into Greek, along with this larger narrative of presenting Judaism as a kind of philosophy way of living to this pagan king in the narrative.
Yeah, and it is very interesting. Again, if you read through the whole thing, to see even just some of the arguments made from the law,
very
to present
interesting
the laws as a philosophy, right? So, mm-hmm. A lot of the like kashrut laws are more, yeah, I don't know, moralized.
Interesting. I mean, and you find the same thing then happening in like the Epistle of Barnabas and other texts as well. So this is like early on finding a kind of rationale for the dietary laws in this case,
and not eating pigs. It's like, why don't we do this? It's actually morally, I mean, it teaches us a moral lesson, right? That's the
argument.
Yeah.
And underlying all of that is the claim that the law is about piety or worship of the, in this case, the God, and righteousness, dikaiosune. And that also shows up in places in Philo and Josephus. And it seems to be a way of, and several scholars have argued this, I think, convincingly. You see this explicitly in Philo when he talks about the Ten Commandments, a way of kind of summarizing the two tablets that God gives to Moses. The first about piety towards God, and the second, righteousness towards your neighbor. And those are both words that make perfect sense in the broader ancient Mediterranean context. So it's a really convenient way of communicating, like, what's the center of the law towards the audience. And then if you pick that up, when you start reading the questions in the Gospels about what is the greatest commandment, and Jesus combines Deuteronomy 6:5 with Leviticus 19:18, you start to see, okay, this is part of a tradition, that's been going on, and a kind of way of summarizing the two tables of commands that are like the center of the law. So there's a lot of cool connections you can make out of that section in a letter of Aristeas.
No, it's great. And I think the two terms you mentioned are, again, if you go back and read the New Testament and you just ask the question, I'm not saying that dikaiosune always means second table of the law, right? Some people will argue that, and it has to be argued for and whatever, but it is interesting to then ask the question though, is it, if Philo is interpreting it this way or using the word in this way, what does it mean in these passages in Paul? There's all kinds of...
Or another great exercise, for listeners, if you want to try it, read what Jesus says at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. If your dikaiosune does not surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees, and then go read all the different parts of the law that he's interested in. These are all about doing righteousness to your neighbor. Why is that? What is he? Because we often hear your righteousness has to surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And then we all think, oh, Pharisees, legalistic. We have all these kind of weird caricatures of them. But he's actually saying, no, like your righteousness towards your neighbor has to surpass that. Because my argument is that there are certain things that, and this is obviously polemics, Matthew 23, but that the Pharisees are lawbreakers, and because of they're withholding the weightier matters of the law towards their neighbor. And so, it's all concerned about, I think, intrapersonal, I guess, righteousness, or righteousness towards neighbor would probably be a better way of saying it.
So. Yeah, no, that's great. And I have strong opinions about the who the Pharisees were and whatever. I mean, it's just I had the opportunity to take a class with Yair Furstenberg at Hebrew U, who has done some work on the Pharisees, and just like totally convinced about who they are from him. That they were, I mean, they were known by all the Jewish groups as people that made the law easier. And so then again, if you read that passage again, for your righteousness to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees was like, okay, the scribes and the Pharisees, particularly the Pharisees, are not doing the things that they need to be doing. It turns the whole Lutheran reading of that
on
its head, right? Yeah. Because Luther would read it like, these are all impossible, right? Yeah. And Jesus is, presenting a law that you can't do, and then you run to him for grace, yada, yada, yada. Again, not to disparage that tradition, but just to say that that is not the best reading of how the Pharisees were viewed in the ancient world. In the ancient world, consistently, even within Matthew 23, as you point out, they're harped on for being licentious, not legalist, to use the theological terms, right? Yes. And so again, that changes the way you read that text.
Yeah. Yeah. I always remind my students, you know, for the Qumran community, the Pharisees were lax, the seekers of the smooth ways. I mean, these guys are the quote unquote liberals when it comes to the law for some. Yeah. Yeah.
And even within the rabbinic corpus, the way the Sadducees are presented, they get on to the Pharisees for the same things, you know? So it's just, it's across the board, New Testament, Sadducees, the Essenes, like they're all pointing in one direction. And ironically, our culture has it completely flipped. Yeah. And no one reads the actual text. You know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, that's so funny. Yeah. That's
so true. Anyway, this is only tangentially related to our topic. So
It's fun.
It is. Yeah. I know. So let's do one more. Right. I'm just looking. Let's talk about how, like, more classical literature. How were the Jews presented in the ancient world? What do Greek historians say about the Jewish people? And, you know, how might that inform how we read the Jewish authors, and or just in general, you know, what people were thinking about Jews during that time? I mean, again, thinking about Paul going to Asia Minor, right? And talking about a Jewish king who's died, right? And who is now resurrected and Lord of the world, right? How would that have sounded in light of some of these classical authors' presentation of the Jews?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think we see, this might be overly simplistic, but I think we see kind of two things going on with a lot of the ways that other historians and satirists and others speak of the Jewish people. One is, you can definitely see texts where there's disdain, right? Like clear anti-Judaism, mockery of the Jewish people for a variety of things. You know, there's the traditions that they were lepers that were expelled from Egypt, and that's where the Exodus is. That was like the actual story of the Exodus, or that, you know, when Antiochus stormed into the temple, there actually was an image there. It was Moses riding an ass, you know, so these kind of things. And then jokes, obviously, about circumcision and stuff like that. But what a lot of that material also shows, I think, is there's a fairly, and you see this, I think, in Josephus, there's a pretty broad interest in Judaism in the ancient world. Like there's a subsegment of the broader pagan world that is drawn to Judaism, or Judaism as a kind of philosophy way of life. And so you see it making inroads with, at times, prominent political figures, leading men and women. Josephus highlights that. Also, Luke in Acts highlights that as well with the early Jesus movement, that it makes inroads with these kind of figures. And then, of course, that can create problems for them potentially as well. So, yeah, I think on the one hand, we can see these traditions that are disparaging of Judaism, and even some authors that maybe make fun of the Jewish people. But we also see, I think, within that and alongside that, ample evidence that Judaism as a way of life was interesting, maybe not exclusively, but as to a subset of the pagan audience. And I think Acts of the Apostles provides really strong evidence for that. You don't have to take everything in Acts historically to see that diasporic Judaism is really the seedbed for how the early Jesus movement spreads, according to Acts. And even at Pentecost, which, again, people often miss this, Luke says there are Jews or Judean, you know, Judaioi from every place under the sun present there. That is a statement about the diverse nature of the ethnic groups that now make up Judaism, as Luke is writing. So that's further evidence for the proliferation of Jewish communities throughout the ancient Mediterranean world. And I think that's important to highlight, because a lot of times Christianity is presented as this universalist, like going beyond the bounds, and Judaism is this like particular thing that keeps to itself. And you can certainly find Jewish texts that are that way. But there are a lot of Jewish texts that are very, and Jewish communities behind them that are very open to their neighbor. And I think they are, in many ways, kind of the forerunners to some of the spread of the Jesus movement that we see in Acts, for example. Your question, I hope that hit your question. Was there anything?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I think that's great. I think there's, yeah, I mean, again, if you read those authors, you do see, like you mentioned, things said about the Jews that are not nice, you know, just put it that way. But at the same time, there is a, you know, sort of like particular fascination, even like, why are you talking about these people, right? Because they're different,
right?
And that difference is attracting both, you know, disdain from some people and some people to actually join or to go to synagogue and listen to Torah read. And I think you're exactly right. You know, when you read Acts, it really only makes sense if that's the case, right? Like why are there people in the synagogue that are God-fearers and they're not Jews, right? I mean, why are there, you know, even in Acts 15, Moses is read all over the place.
Yep.
You know, why can we say these laws and have the Gentiles follow them? Because everyone knows them already, right? I mean, that's a pretty remarkable statement. And it does show that at the very least, Jews that were very well known or the Jewish, you know, culture and religion, maybe there wasn't much of a difference between them, those two at the time, but they were very influential, even if they were disdained by some.
Yeah. 100%. And it's great to I think it's important we're highlighting that. A lot of scholars have been highlighting that recently because so often the story of Christian origins has been told without any Jewish perspective or Jewish voice in that story. And I think it's a sad history that a lot of times people have felt like the only way to make Christianity look good is to have a negative foil. And that negative foil has had to be Judaism often. And I think when we change the conversation, it's more helpful, but it also leads to better history. It also leads to a better reading of the New Testament, you know?
Yeah, for sure. So just some concluding questions. So let's say students have gone through your book. Where do you suggest they go from here in terms of like easiest material or most important material?
Yeah. So easiest, I think we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, but easiest would be you say, okay, I've worked through this. I want to read through a whole book of Septuagint text. I think that could be a very doable thing. You could probably do that, you know, after working through even part of the book. I think you'd feel comfortable to do that. And that would also be great because if we're talking about most important for understanding the New Testament, well, these are the scriptures for the authors you're reading in the New Testament. So that kind of kills two birds with one stone. I think people would do well to read through the Apostolic Fathers in Greek. That is very doable. And, you know, again, even if we work through part of the book, that's something you could do. There's great copies that are available. Baker has one that Michael Holmes did with Greek and English facing. Bart Ehrman has the one for the Loeb Library. Again, Greek with English facing. That's always tricky because you're tempted to look at the English, but you know, it can be helpful sometimes too. But reading through Apostolic Fathers, I think people would love that. Like, and that's something that is very easy to do. In terms of like most important, yeah, I mean, those would be up there, most important. I think I always encourage people really wanting to study the New Testament, spend time in the Old Testament pseudepigrapha. There's just a lot of material there. And then also you have to realize like that's a name we're giving to a very diverse group of texts. So within that, some are more important than others and sure. So on and so forth. I mean, some of them are way later than the New Testament. But yeah, reading some of those, I think would be awesome.
Where do you think they should start within that literature?
If you're looking for ease, the novel Joseph and Asenath, I think would be the easiest place to start, or one of them. There are other ones that you could read that are translations of other texts. So like First Enoch is a really important text. I didn't include it in this reader because it was originally written in, well, there's different parts, but like the Aramaic and Hebrew. And then we have some Greek manuscripts that preserve it. And so you can read copies of that in Greek. That would be another one you could definitely do pretty easily. I really hope people get into Philo and Josephus. That's why I gave a lot of time to both of them. Philo, these are our two most prolific Jewish authors of the period of the New Testament. And so they deserve a lot of time and attention. Philo is... he's going to take you a little bit of time. If you've never read any Philo, he's an acquired taste. Let's just say that it takes him. You've got to acclimate yourself first to Philo. I mean, I've talked to New Testament scholars who are like, I try to read Philo. I don't know what the heck is going on there, but
you're being nice about how it's hard.
It's hard. It is hard. But there is a lot of payoff there, I think, with reading through Philo. A lot of connections that you'll make to the New Testament. Josephus, likewise, right? He is our primary source for the history of that of the land of Israel in that time period. And so, yeah, you're going to want to read as much of Josephus as you can. And these are two, like, we're talking about major works, right? So I would recommend, like, if you're going to read Philo, I think On Special Laws is a great place to start. Really, really intriguing text. You're going to get a lot of stuff on creation, really interesting stuff on the early chapters of Genesis in there. So I included some of that in there. Yeah, I definitely hope this will inspire some people to get into reading some classical or Attic authors as well. Something like, I have some sections on like Plato's Apology, and I think that's a really fun text to read. And you make some really interesting connections in there as well. I think that I'm persuaded that there are some allusions to the Apology in the New Testament. For example, the line where John and Peter say, you know, we have to obey God rather than man. That's almost verbatim in Greek what Plato says. I'm sorry, what Socrates says when he's on trial. I have to obey the God rather than human beings. And even the way of speaking, you know, oh, Athenians, like, you have that rhetorical a structure of speaking to the assembly. You're going to see that coming out in the New Testament as well. So you just start making all kinds of connections if you read outside. So yeah, I would say, this is just my personal opinion, but I would say whatever you are most interested in, you're most likely to be passionate about and to stick to, I would go from there to that, right? That would be my first inclination and be like, all right, are you interested in this author? Let's work through these sections, and then why don't you consider, you know, getting a work by this author and working your way through it. And you gave really good advice at the beginning. The way to really make these jumps in advance is to read it over and over and over again. The first few times you read it, you're just kind of acclimating it, you know, you're getting used to it, and then you can read through it at a greater pace. And now you're going to see new things. In my own experience, the first text I ever read through wasn't in seminary. It was in a classics program. It was Euripides' Bacchae. And I had to read that text so many times before I even came to class, just so I didn't feel like an idiot when we were reading it in class. But that proved to me precisely the point that you were making about reading, that you need to familiarize yourself with the text. You need to read it over and over. And then you start reading it through, and that whole process doesn't just pay dividends for that one work. It kind of snowballs. So doing that, then you go to the next text. Yeah, you're going to have some new things, you know, new challenges. I mean, for me, it was Homer, and that was like, oh no, I don't even know Greek. But you do it over and over and over again. And as you stick with it, you're going to continue to make these improvements, and you got to celebrate those things. Like, when you feel like you've hit a new marker in your Greek reading, like, enjoy that, celebrate that, and realize, like, the more time, you know, this investment is paying off, and more and more texts are becoming available to you as things you can read. So yeah, just a word of encouragement, it's worth it, right? Like, the investment in reading Greek is worth it. It is one of the things that I'm most happy about with my study. Like, there's a lot of things I've studied in life that I'm like, did I really need that? You know, how much secondary literature can you actually read on Paul? You know, whatever. but with Greek, every minute, every second I put into it has been worth it. And again, I'm assuming many people who are listening to this and who buy the book are doing it because they want to read the New Testament better. I 100% guarantee you, if you work through this book, you will read the New Testament better. You'll be reading through whole books of the New Testament without even maybe having to open up any secondary helps. And that will be life-changing.
Yeah. Well, we should just end there. So that is a great thing to end on. And I just really appreciate you coming on to the podcast and sharing with us your expertise and just your passion for reading Greek. I mean, like you said, and I just totally concur on this, that it's something you won't regret, just reading through the original text. And it's sad that people are doing so much less of that now than they were, you know, 100 years ago, you know.
It's true.
And so we're having to fight, you know, to get back to the place where we really should be, because if people aren't doing this, it affects our translations, our understanding in general of Greek grammar and the world of the New Testament. I mean, it's just, it's all embedded in these texts.
100%. Yeah. Well, thanks, Kevin. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the work that you guys do a lot. And yeah, it's been really a treat to get to talk to you on this. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. So thank you to all of our listeners as well out there who have taken the time to listen to the Biblical Languages podcast brought to you by Biblingo. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Thank you for listening to the Biblical Languages podcast brought to you by Biblingo. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review. You can also follow Biblingo on social media to discuss the episode with us and other listeners. And don't forget to visit biblingo.org to start your 10-day free trial of Biblingo.